Hi, everybody. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. I am very excited about today's show because my guest is none other than food world legend, Dorina Allen. Dorina is the co-founder of the world-famous Ballymaloe Cookery School in County Cork, Ireland. She has authored 21 cookbooks, including her latest, Dorina Allen, How to Cook. She is a champion of the slow food movement, and she believes passionately that children should be taught both how to cook and where their food comes from. Also, Dorina helped popularize the idea of farmers markets in Ireland. She shares that story with us and how it includes another culinary superstar, Marcella Hazan. I'm thrilled to catch up with Dorina because I have not seen her since 2019, when I took my first trip to Ireland and visited Ballymaloe, which includes a 100-acre organic farm. It was such a beautiful day, and Ballymaloe is such a beautiful place. I was actually moved to tears. Today's show is presented by Kerrygold, the makers of beautiful butter and cheese made with milk from Irish grass-fed cows. There we go. Speaking of Ireland, we'll hear more from Kerrygold in just a moment. A little housekeeping. The latest issue of Cherry Bomb magazine is here. It's issue 18, and it is a celebration of beautiful baked goods. We have 6 different covers for you to choose from, including video superstar Claire Saffitz and Zoe Francois of the TV show Zoe Bakes. Zoe was actually with me on that trip to Ireland. How about that? Visit cherrybomb.com to see all the covers and to find a shop near you that carries our magazine. Speaking of baking, check out our Holiday Brunch Club video series with Free People. We love the Free People people. First up is baker Caroline Schiff, who was just on Radio Cherry Bomb a few weeks ago. I hope you all caught that episode. You can watch Caroline's how-to video and get her recipe for her sage, maple, and aged cheddar scones on cherrybomb.com. Now, let's hear a quick word from Kerrygold, then we'll be right back with Dorina Allen of Ballymaloe.
Kerrygold is delicious, all-natural butter and cheese, made with milk from Irish grass-fed cows. Our farming families pass their craft and knowledge from generation to generation.
I'm fifth generation. It goes back over 250 years.
This traditional approach is the reason for the rich taste of Kerrygold. Enjoy delicious new sliced or shredded Kerrygold cheddar cheese. Available in mild or savoury flavours at a retailer near you. Find your nearest store at kerrygoldusa.com.
Dorina Allen, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Oh, I feel I've arrived.
You feel so you've arrived. Delighted. I am so honored. You have no idea.
Well, you know, hello, Mutual Admiration Club here. Good.
How are things at Ballymaloe?
Well, good. You know, it's been quite the roller coaster, hasn't it, for the last couple of years. And so we're just keeping on. But at the moment, Ireland has come out of this really last 3 months of lockdown, and so Ballymaloe House, the country house hotel and restaurant, that's been back in business for a couple of months now and super busy. And then here at the cooking school, we're a cooking school and organic farm and garden. So but even though we had to close the cooking school in the initial lockdown, in week 10 of a 12-week course, and there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. The students were heartbroken not to be able to finish the course. But anyway, the toughest times of lockdown, we still kept on 19 of our wonderful team here. All of our gardeners and our farming team stayed on. So basically, we have a farm shop here on the farm where, as you may know, the cooking school is right down on the south coast of Ireland. I'll paint a little picture for you. Quite close to the sea, the little fishing village of Ballycotton is only 2 miles from us. And the school is in the middle of a 100-acre organic farm and garden. So at that time, it was March. And so we desperately needed to sow seeds. And so the teachers, you know, who stayed on, they cooked for the farm shop. We expanded the farm shop because they were the two essential services that were allowed to stay open at that time, of course, were anything to do with food or to do with medicine. So we expanded the farm shop to feed the local community, who were at that time, it was a 5K, that was as far as you could travel, 5K from your home. And so the teachers cooked and expanded the range of things there, not just you know, just normally our organic vegetables and fruit and the milk from our little micro dairy. I'm a dairy farmer. I've got 9 Jersey cows. The proper dairy farmers think I'm a joke. But anyway, we do have all of our milk and we make our own butter and cheese and yogurt. So we had all of that lovely, crusty and natural sourdough bread coming out of the bread shed every day. And of course, the hens were laying and all of that sort of thing. None of that stopped during COVID. So we continued all of that. And the teachers who weren't cooking for the shop went down onto the farm and they helped to sow the seeds and plant the plants and vice versa. So they learned new skills. And I can tell you, they learned a greater appreciation for the farmers and from the food producers and gardeners. When you see what goes into producing food, there's nothing like sowing a seed and waiting for it to grow into something delicious to eat. And then you realize how long it takes to grow a bunch of carrots or beets or something. And every time after that, every time you see a farmer, you want to give them a hug. And you never complain about the price of food again. And the other wonderful thing is you won't want to waste a scrap.
Jarena, I'd love to go back to the beginning and hear a little bit about your childhood. I know your mom did the cooking. Tell us what she was cooking.
I'm 73 at this stage, but I'm very lucky to still have lots of energy, however long that's going to last. But anyway, I'm the eldest of a big Irish family, a family of 9, and my mother loved to cook. She loved to cook. And she was a very good home cook. We had our own kitchen garden. We had our own hens, of course. We went to school in the little local school, literally down the hill in the village. And, you know, I always remember, we looked forward to every meal. We thought that was everybody's norm, really. And you know, now I know also a lot of children, of course, going to the little school in the village would have brought a little school lunch with them, a little sandwich or something. But Mummy had got permission from the headmaster for us to run back up the hill for lunch every day. And I didn't even think about that until years later. But now I realize how fortunate we were because we had a lovely, nourishing, delicious, bubbly stew or something lovely for lunch every day. Simple, homeless, gorgeous, real food. And always a dessert. It might be stewed apple and custard, or it could be rhubarb or gooseberries or something in season, or a pie or something. And so now I realize that, touch wood, I suppose we are all living on inherited good health and to a certain extent what we ate. But how fortunate was I to have been brought up on this really delicious, nourishing food before any of us even talked about food, if you know what I mean. You know, in the winter, she'd make us steamed puddings, lovely steamed puddings. And at Christmas, there were special things. There's Easter and the whole year. Of course, at that stage, needless to say, all the food was seasonal food, you know, which was the food of the area.
Sadly, when you were a child, your dad passed when you were young and you were sent to boarding school. And I had read that you had some very progressive nuns who were running the boarding school. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, my father actually died. He was a very heavy smoker at a time when I think people didn't quite realize how dangerous smoking was. He died when I was 14. But I was already at boarding school since I was 11, because at that stage, you know, if there wasn't a very good school near you, you would go to boarding school. So I was educated by lovely Dominican sisters, and they were considered, indeed were, very, you know, progressive nuns, very visionary nuns. And this is in the early 60s now, before maybe your parents were born. But anyway, and they were encouraging us girls, and it was all girls, of course, in that school, to have a proper career, to do law, to do the sciences, to medicine, to architecture, whatever. And of course, I knew nothing about any of that. So all I knew about was really growing or cooking. And I love cooking because it was always going on. You can imagine with 9 of us in our kitchen at home, there was always cooking going on. When we tidied up from one meal, it was time to almost start to cook for another. So I loved cooking. I'd got that from my mother without any conversations about it, really. And then I also loved gardening because my mother and both my grandfathers loved their gardens. And we had, as I said, a kitchen garden. And in fact, Mummy also, one of the men in the yard, helped her to rear chickens for the table and all of that. So you can imagine how I thought this was the norm. Anyway, it was wonderful. Then it came to, of course, at the end of my 5 years in Wicklow, Dominican Convent of Wicklow, and what to do. So the nuns, as I explained to you, were very much encouraging us girls to have a career. Now, you might say, well, of course they were. Well, in the 60s, many people, you know, actually, honestly, the height of my ambition too at that stage really was, you know, I wanted to do something, get a job, you know, and then just to pass the time until I found a nice chap, preferably with a bit of money. And then I would have, I would
swear. The truth comes out.
Feet from off his feet, and then we'd have a few cute little kids, and we'd go and pick me up, paint my nails, all that. So that was about the height of my ambition, but the nuns were having none of that. We had to have, so anyway, I said, I really wanted to cook. I wanted to learn how to cook. Now, again, this is at a time when to say that cooks, chefs and cooks had no status is an understatement. You just never heard about a chef or a cook. It was long before the celebrity chef thing. And basically, even worse than that then, men were chefs and women, you know, just couldn't get into a top restaurant kitchen or whatever. So, and so anyway, that was a real problem. So, and of course, the nuns, you know, drew themselves up to their full height and said, and I said, I just would like to either cook or else I'd like to garden. And I remember one little nun, she was quite small, she drawing herself up to a full height and with her the nose in the air, she said, well, you're never going to need that, my dear. You know, you're going to be a career woman and you're going to have your own cook and somebody to do your grounds, your gardens and all that. And anyway, I persisted much to their disappointment. And so they said, well, okay, if you insist, then it must be a degree in horticulture or it must be either a degree in horticulture or else hotel management. So anyway, I had to opt for one or the other. So I then decided to do hotel management, and I applied and got into, eventually, only on the second count, got into the Carl Brewer Street in Dublin, which is a very, very good hotel school in Dublin, which is now DIT. And but anyway, I ended up then years later marrying a farmer and horticulturist. So now I have both. But anyway, I was very fortunate. But I went to Carl Brewer Street, and then at the end of that management course, again, dilemma, what to do now. So basically, the sort of thing you would aspire to, having done a management course, was to be an assistant manager in one of the top hotels in Dublin or London or whatever. And off you'd go, and you'd have a lovely little uniform and a little badge saying your name and assistant manager. I wasn't interested in that at all. I just wanted to cook. And so everybody else in my class had a job. And I remember quite close to the end of the course, there were only 20-something in my class at that time. Now there would be 400, you know. So one of the senior tutors met me in the corridor one day. And she said, haven't you got a job yet? Why don't you have a job? Everybody else in your class has a job. And I said, told her what I wanted. I really wanted to cook. And I couldn't get into, you know, the Russell or Jamais or whatever. And I wanted to learn. I had a fixation about homemade ice cream and souffles and the sort of things that sounded so, you know, wonderful and exotic in the 60s. I wanted to learn more about fresh herbs as well, because I knew about parsley and, gosh, imagine this. I knew about parsley. I think I knew about thyme, maybe chives, basil. It was 20 years before I knew about basil. But basically, anyway, Moore Marnahan was the name of, I remember distinctly the name of this professor. And She told me I was far too fussy. But anyway, she said, funny. She said, can't you be like the rest of them? You know, why can't you be like the rest of them? So anyway, she said, but funny, I was at a dinner party the other night and they were talking about this woman, this extraordinary woman down in Cork. She's a farmer's wife. And they seem to have opened a restaurant in their own house. It's a great big house on a farm right out in the country. The avenue is miles long. But she said, you're from the country. You know, perhaps you'd like that. And she said, and they have their own Jersey herd. So I know them. She makes her own homemade ice cream from the Jersey cream. And they have their own pigs. So they have their own pork. They have a big walled garden. And she writes the menu every day, depending on, you know, what's in the garden. And they're close to the sea. There's a little fishing village down there called Ballycotton. And, you know, she just writes the menu and puts the whatever fish she can get on the menu every day. Every day, and I couldn't believe my ears. It was like ticking all the boxes, you know, the ice cream, the herbs, the everything else. And then she said,
it sounded like heaven to you,
Doreen. It sounded like heaven to me. And so, anyway, she couldn't remember her name, but she said, look, if you like, I'll go and ask my friend. Now, by the way, all of that was in incredulous tones, because this is actually at a time when nobody opened a restaurant out in the country, to say the very least of it. But apart from that, when restaurants opened, the chef wrote the menu, and it was the same, could be the same 10 years later. So the idea of writing a menu every day and putting feeding people the sort of food that you might serve to your family and friends was unheard of.
So what was Ballymaloe like when you arrived?
Oh, Ballymaloe. Ballymaloe was very similar to what it is now, really, in many ways. A big old country house that has been added to in many times. Part of it is Georgian. In fact, the earliest part is 14th century. It's a Geraldine castle, which is that part of it is not derelict now. The castle is still there, but it's not used as a bedroom or anything. And then, of course, I arrived in and, it was very quiet at that time. I arrived the 15th of June, I think, that year. There were no guests staying. And I was just a member. Actually, the first person I met was Timmy, because I remember when we were driving up this interminable avenue. It's quite a long avenue because it was very, you see, years ago for great houses, it was, or big houses, it was very fashionable to have a big long avenue, the Longview Avenues. That was the sort of starter's thing. But anyway, I drove up and then I walked in and there didn't seem to be anybody in the hotel. It was like Mary Celeste, really. And I'd seen some people playing golf, just a couple of people playing golf on what looked like the beginning of a golf course as we drove up by the side of the avenue. And as we were going out thinking, there's nobody here, that's it. Basically, there is funny looking long haired fellow in long hair with long hair at a time when, again, that was super cool. Very first of the long hair for men. And then shorts and bare feet ran up. And he said, are you the person who's coming to help us? It's also lovely in many ways. And anyway, that was Timmy. I thought, he's cute, but he was smaller than me at that stage. and he's younger than me, but it was more apparent at that stage. He was 20 when we got married, and I was 21. Anyway, he grew about 2 inches after we got married. All the good.
So the first meeting, you did not.
He murdered me for saying that, but anyway.
So your first meeting, you did not think, this is the man I will marry.
Well, I know, but I did think he was, as you would now say, cute. But anyway, and he had one girlfriend after the other all summer. And then in the winter, there was nobody else much around.
So you got there and you basically never left.
I got there and I never left. That's absolutely true.
How would you have described Irish cuisine back then? Was that even a term that anyone would have used?
I'm not sure people would have put Irish and cuisine in the same thing. Well, people really knew then that you had to feed yourself as well as possible to try and, you know, build up your immune system against colds and flus. And I don't even know, I suppose there were viruses then. Farming groups from, you know, Europe and all over Ireland and the UK used to come to see the farm. And occasionally then they would always, of course, offer hospitality and sometimes lunch and everything. And at one stage then, the editor of the Irish Farmers Journal, which is a wide circulation farming newspaper here in Ireland, goes into practically every house in every parish in the country. So he asked Myrtle, he said, that was a lovely lunch you cooked to Myrtle. Would you ever start writing a column, A Farmer's Wife, writing for farmers' wives? So she wrote in the Farmers Journal for many, many years. And it's like a wonderful social diary of food in Ireland. And so basically, and also at that time in Ireland, Myrtle had traveled a bit and all, much more now than many other farmers' wives. But also she totally knew, as I said, you know, about the quality. She believed in the quality of produce we had in Ireland. But the rest of us all had an incredible inferiority complex. And, you know, a lot of Irish food was shocking. I mean, really shocking. And
how so?
We also, because, well, just was all kind of boiled meat and boiled vegetables, boiled to death and, you know, nothing particularly interesting or exciting. But anyway, as a whole, as a country, we had an inferiority complex about Ireland and Irish produce and Irish this and Irish that. We were sure that what you had in America, certainly, and even in the UK, had to be more exciting than what we had here. And actually, that now, of course, that has changed a lot. Ireland is now a very confident nation, highly educated young people, traveling a lot, all that kind of thing. But I had I've had a couple of eureka moments in my life, and one of them was actually around this whole thing. Local, of course, was, when I was a child, it was pretty much a derogatory term. I mean, there was one other little shop in the village, and if Mrs. Freeman if somebody brought in some surplus eggs or apples from their orchard or something to sell, you know, people would expect to buy them for less because they were local. Anyway, keep that thought in your head. Okay. So off I go to Italy. I think it was before I started the cooking school. I started the Bagnu cooking school in 1983. But basically, I went off to Italy, actually, to learn about Italian food. And I went to my lovely Marcella Hazan, can you imagine? But anyway, I went along, and during that, we went to the, I went to, at one stage, the Rialto Market in Florence. And basically, I noticed, I'd been told about the produce in Italy, you know, wonderful fruit and vegetables and fish and shellfish. Everything was, the whole inference was 20 times better than what we had in Ireland. And anyway, went along, and there were all these beautiful stalls piled high with everything, peaches and tomatoes and everything. And I noticed that often on the stalls, there could be two different things on the stall. It might be two lots of peaches, two lots of tomatoes, and one lot was always more expensive than the other. And the one where they were more expensive always had a little label on it. Now, if you speak Italian, you know what this is. But anyway, the little label on it saying Nostrana or Nostrale. And I thought, where is this wonderful place, Nostrana or Nostrale, where all the best things come from? And I was trying to ask, no Italian, the impatient stallholders, because they're sick and tired of tourists trying to ask them questions and take photographs and not buy anything. Anyway, eventually one of them did try to understand what I was saying. And I said, where is this place? Where is this place where all the best things come from? And he said, it's not a place. It means it comes from the lagoon. And I said, well, why the lagoon? He said, it's local. And I said, well, if it's local, why is it more expensive? He said to me, it's fresher, it's better, it's local, it's in season.
And it took you going to Italy to have that light bulb moment.
It took me going to Italy, and it was like, bring. Of course it's better, it's fresher, and of course the Italians have it right. So every time I came back, I told everybody for months about that. And then when, of course, later on in that trip, actually, Marcella Bizan had been talking about this wonderful fish dinner we would have in her hometown called Cesenatico on the Adriatic, where this wonderful fish and shellfish came from. And I lived beside Bancotton. Anyway, so I, again, was all prepared for this amazing difference in taste. Sat down to supper came. I remember the name of the restaurant still. It was called La Gambera. I'm sure I'm making a mess of that pronunciation. I think that's prawn or shrimp or something. And anyway, then the fish came and the shellfish. And then I tasted and I thought, oh my God, this is very good. But it's what we get from Ballycotton. The summer place in Ballycotton is miles better than this. And I thought what Myrtle said all along about the quality of the produce we have in Ireland, that we don't realize how good it is. That was my second like one moment. So I came back. I remember saying to Timmy, the answer to trying to keep a roof over our heads, this is at a time when the bottom is falling out of farming, is under our feet.
Could you tell us what you learned from Marcella? Did you two cook together?
Well, basically, Marcella, I think, was the first person to actually do those kind of holiday cooking things where you went to the markets and went to cheesemaker, wine maker, etc. Anyway, and Marcella did not suffer fools gladly, as you know, and she was fantastic. I loved it. She'd have a cigarette. She always had, she'd be stirring the pot with one hand and a cigarette in the other. Now, this is all during cooking. And then there was always a lovely bottle of Jack Daniels quite close by. I loved Marcella. I went back to film with her years later, actually. But I learned, one of the main things I wanted to learn was how to make pasta, how to make fresh pasta. But Marcella, it was so funny. There was only one right way of doing something. There was no, you know, and I remember it must have been, I certainly hadn't seen them in Ireland, but the Maggi mixes, or not Maggi mixes, what do you call them, food processors, must have just come on stream in America at that time. And I remember I was the only non-American on the course. There were about 10 of us. So she couldn't understand where she got an Irish farmer's wife. I mean, I didn't even have the cooking skills at that time. I was an Irish farmer's wife and still am. But basically, there was no more to it. I wasn't a food writer or anything. But they were intrigued because they thought I was some kind of spy or something. there had to be more to it. And I was like the teacher's pet in some ways, because they would either Victor or self would ask me to sit beside them virtually every night. And I think they were determined to get to the bottom of what they thought was some intrigue. God, I've forgotten what the question was. You asked me, what did I ask?
Just what you had learned from Marcella.
Yes. So basically, I can't remember. There was something else I was going to tell you. I learned. Oh yeah. Oh yes, I remember one unfortunate student had the temerity to ask her if they could make pesto in a food processor. You know, because of course she made pesto, pounding it in a pestle and mortar. Well, my goodness, did that person get a telling off? And in the end, and you know, they said, well, this is the. This girl said, well, these are the machines of the future, blah, 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 and all this. And Marcella was having none of it. And she just about would agree that she could, put the basil and the pine nuts and things into the food processor. But there was no question of folding in the cheese. You had to pour that into a bowl and then fold in the cheese. And to this day, I'm teaching students here how to make pesto from our own beautiful basil. It was pretty much, I think that was the first time I came across basil, actually, as well. It was on that trip to Italy. And anytime I'm teaching the students, I tell them the story. And I insist that they fold in the grated parmesan, beautiful grated parmesan into the cheese, because she used to say it with oil otherwise. And I could see Marcella sitting on my shoulder, and I feel she would appear to me if I, under any circumstances, put the parmesan into the food processor.
Oh my gosh. Oh, Darina, that is so funny, because there's a Canadian TV show that became really popular in America called Schitt's Creek. It's spelled Schitt's about this family that falls on hard times, this very wealthy family that falls on hard times, and they have to move to the small town. And one of the funniest and most famous episodes, there's a scene about folding in the cheese, and the mother is trying to teach the son, who has never, you know, touched anything in a kitchen, how to cook. And she's like, and then you fold in the cheese. And he's like, you what? And she's like, fold in the cheese. And they have this hilarious conversation about what it means to fold in the cheese. And I'm going to send you the video clip.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love that.
Now, I read that you started the first farmers markets in Ireland. So is that true?
You asked me, of all the bits and pieces I've been involved in over the years, and I've been involved in a lot of different things, what is the thing that I got the most satisfaction or feel proudest of, if you want to put it that way? And it's actually of having started or restarted the markets, or the farmers markets in Ireland. When people come to Ireland, do visit. There's a wonderful, what we call the English markets. It's a covered market that's open for 6 days a week there in the middle of Cork City. Anyway, we started at the farmers market there, and then a number of years later, I set up one in Middleton, and then now there are 160-170 farmers markets in Ireland. And basically, it is so many farmers have told me that they would not be still on the land if it wasn't for the farmers markets, that they can sell their food direct, particularly small farmers. So that's been, and I remember I wrote about it in the Farmers Journal, as we mentioned earlier, about this terrific new thing, movement in America. And so many of the best things start in America. So many things, the artisan breweries, the artisan bakeries, because you're further down the road of desperation than we are. Oh, and don't misunderstand that now. But basically, you know, because you had, processed food before we had, and you saw the effect of that on people's health, you know, and then when the beer is so bloody awful, you couldn't drink it. The arson brewery started when the bread got so awful, you couldn't eat it. The, you know, I think it was Acme Bakery might have been the first one. So basically, you know, human nature fights back. So many of the best things I learned from America. So I wrote in the Farmers Journal about this great new movement that was in America, these farmers markets, and it could be part of a solution for many farmers who were finding it very tough, because the whole cheap food policy, remember, had kicked in at that stage. And so anyway, I remember getting, after that letter, suggesting that, you know, farmers got together and set up farmers markets around the country and all of that, I actually got hate mail.
No.
This long before the people, I remember getting, I wish I kept this letter, maybe it's somewhere in the archives, but anyway, I got this letter from this furious farmer who was outraged. He said, how dare you insult us by saying we should, you know, set up a stall on the side of the street. We want to be on our knees. You see, the problem was, because of our history in Ireland, that sort of thing was raw, because basically people really felt that if you set up a stall on the side of the street, it meant you were sort of almost in desperation. So that was not well received at that time. And I remember years later, the farmers markets, then people would come and see our farmers market, and it was really vibrant, and the farmers and, you know, and all sorts of producers selling wonderful food and everything. And people came to look at it. People came from abroad. Television crews came to film it, radio stations. So it became quite a talking point, and lots of farmers markets set up. And then about 10 years later, I wrote almost an identical article for the Farmers Journal. And the next time I said, I can give you a little kit of, you know, how to set up a farmers market, you know, free and everything, because I was so anxious for this to spread. And next time there was a much more positive response to it. People had realized that it's not the solution for everybody, but it can be a part solution. And, you know, it's so convivial, and the local community is so grateful when somebody in people in the community decide to set up a farmer's market.
Did you meet Alice Waters on that trip?
Oh, I can't remember when the first, which trip now.
So you two are certainly kindred spirits.
Yeah, it was either on the very early, that first trip, or it could have been on earlier trips that I met Alice. And gosh, we're kind of like soul sisters in a way. She's a teeny bit older than me, but she looks a heck of a lot better. And she always looks so glamorous, Alice. And of course, I love Alice. We've been friends for many, many years. And of course, you can imagine we're on the same page about a lot of things. And so inspired by her Edible Schoolyard project as well. And I haven't met her for, of course, over 2 years now. Yeah.
Let's talk about the cookery school. You used the word desperation a little bit a little earlier. People might not realize this, but the cookery school at Ballymaloe was opened out of desperation. Can you tell us that story?
Totally, it was. Desperation is a wonderful thing. You know, when your back is to the wall, it's amazing what you can come up with. Well, I suppose I'm talking about, we got married in 1970. And then Ireland went into the EU in 1973, in the European Union in 1973. And then that was a period of great change. You know, the labour costs started to rise. There were lots of these tidal wave of regulations started to pour in from the EU about, you know, food, you know, grading and all kinds of things. And then there was the oil, crisis. Towards the end of the 1970s, early 80s, there was an incredible recession in Ireland. And there was the oil crisis, there was 25% inflation. We were heating 5 acres of greenhouses with oil. These were greenhouses that actually needed quite an investment. We used to export tomatoes, mushrooms, all of that. So we were heating them with oil, and the price of oil went up 400% in 1 year. And as I said, labor costs started to rise. There was this incredible inflation, and then the whole cheap food policy kicked in. So in other words, any farmer or food producers, it's got worse and worse ever since. But anyway, would suddenly realize that we're getting less for their produce every year rather than more. And all the time there was this sort of, you know, pressure to cut costs and all of that so that everybody could have cheap food. I mean, the whole cheap food thing is probably the greatest disaster in health terms and socioeconomic terms. It's not just in Ireland, it's all over the world. And of course, everybody deserves and needs to have healthy, wholesome food. It doesn't have to be expensive. But basically, what's happened is that in this whole you know, race to make food cheaper and cheaper, the food is less and less nutritious all the time. You can see that on the vitamin mineral tables. It's terrifying. We're very lucky now if a lot of the food is even vegetables and fruit and everything has 50% of the nutrients in it than it used to have in the 1950s. And this is, you know, make food cheap at all costs. It's a myth. There's no such thing as cheap food. It's far too expensive in health terms and socioeconomic terms. And basically, as taxpayers, we're paying for it four or five times over, or in our taxes, we're paying for it to provide subsidies to back up a totally unsustainable food system. And it's seen to be so. We have COP going on in Glasgow at the moment, trying to do, you know, something about, you know, our responsibility to respond to the, you know, the climate change and all of the things that have led to that. But basically, all of these things. Oh, yes. So I was talking about cheap food. So anyway, we as taxpayers, we pay for it to provide the subsidies to back up that obviously unsustainable system. We need to fund the health service, to clean up the water, to clean up the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So we're paying for it five times over. And really, you know, there are several people like the Sustainable Food Trust. I think the Rodell Institute over the years, the Savory Institute have all done, you know, research on the true cost, what they call true cost accounting, the real price of food. And it's about five times what we pay for it on the shelves. So all of these things, it was like a perfect storm. So all of these things happened. We were getting less for our produce than we had for years and years. And so I remember at one stage, we used to deal with the wholesalers. We would sell our produce to the wholesalers in Cork. That's what I was done. And somebody said, forget about the wholesalers. This, the supermarkets are the thing of the future. So we were delighted. We got a contract with one of the big Irish supermarkets, which are still here, lots and lots of branches, and because they were getting criticism because they had no Irish apples. So we sent our lovely apples into them, beautifully graded. I mean, we had a big grading house and everything. And I remember we made a contract, of course, and a deal and all of that. And then somehow we never seemed to be paid quite what we had agreed. And oftentimes they would send back some if they found a little bruise on an apple or something, and everything was really carefully graded. This was not a Mickey Mouse operation here. And then I remember this went on and on, and then suddenly we began to realize this was not just an accidental thing. It would look like it was actually policy. Well, now of course we know it's policy, but anyway, I remember at one stage my husband arriving in, coming back from Cork, and we would have breakfast in I'd sent off the children to school, and we'd have breakfast together every day when he came back from Cork. And I remember he walked in through the kitchen door. I can still see him looking even more despondent than ever. And he said to me, I don't care if I have to crawl on my knees. I'm never doing that again. We have to find a different way to earn a living. So we're a young married couple. At that stage, we had three, if not four children. And we basically were absolutely looking at the possibility of losing the roof over our heads. And we've been inherited this lovely 100-acre farm, plus a lovely house from my parents-in-law, and they'd said quite rightly, well, now you get on with it and keep the roof over your heads. So we were very, very much in danger of losing the roof over our heads. And so we had to look at what talents we had and what resources we had between us. We were young, we had energy, no money, and see how we could earn a living. And if you remember back quite a long time, the conversation, my only ambition was actually to find a nice chap. I didn't want to be any kind of career woman or anything. So anyway, we looked and see, and I often joke that he put me out to work, and I could cook. I loved to cook. And at that stage, I'd actually, with Myrtle, had been helping Myrtle to give some cooking classes in the winter. You know, and Ballymaloe would be quiet in the winter, and Myrtle, again, you know, in so many ways, a pioneer, had started to give cooking classes, and I was helping her. And I thought maybe I could give some cooking classes. By the way, I come from a long line of mad women, but Myrtle, by that stage, by the way, had decided to open a restaurant in Paris, if you don't mind, called La Ferme Irlandaise, as a shop window for Irish food in Paris, because she knew how much our French guests at Ballymaloe loved the food at Ballymaloe. So basically, she decided that as a shop window for Ireland, which had an appalling reputation for food at that time, she would open on Place du Marché Saint-Honoré, right in the centre of chic Paris. But so anyway, she'd been giving cooking classes. We'd been giving cooking classes for, I suppose, the two previous winters. She was then going off to Paris, in and out of Ballymaloe in Paris.
So wait, Myrtle actually opened that place in Paris?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, totally I did. Totally missed this story.
For 7 or 8 years. It was written up in the New York Times, this extraordinary thing about this farmer's wife opening a restaurant in Paris and all the Parisians queuing around the corner.
I mean, sounds like totally, it should be a TV show, like on HBO or something.
Incredible. So anyway, people were still looking for cooking classes, and Myrtle was doing this. And so Myrtle said, look, why don't you go ahead and do some cooking classes? I said, nobody will ever come and see me. They don't know my name or anything. Of course, they totally didn't. But then we were in desperation. So I started, gave you a series of cooking classes on Saturday mornings. We tied our rusty Renault 4L around the back while all the lovely ladies from Antonotti and Rochestown Road in Cork, who would have been guests of Ballymaloe, came to the cooking classes. And I must say they were so wonderful. I was terrified giving my first class on my own. But then, you know, with anything in life, if you have a go and if you get over the first thing, well, that gives you a bit of confidence to go on. So then we did that. And then I remember a friend of mine in Dublin, who two girls said to me, well, look, why don't you think about everybody, all our friends and everybody, and Ivan and Merkel were desperate for us to find some way to earn a living. And I remember this lovely friend of mine, Pauline O'Kennedy, said, well, look, why don't you think of opening a residential cooking school? But I thought nobody would ever come to a cooking school in the middle of the country. What would they do and everything? But anyway, desperation. So we decided we'd borrow some money and convert some of the farm buildings, a little part of our farm buildings in our yard. We were very fortunate. We had some farm buildings, I'm not sure what you call them in American, around our little courtyard at the back of our house. And we converted that into a little cooking school and opened in September 1983 with 9 students. And you'd be waiting for the phone to ring. And it was so exciting. And then after 10 years, we were bursting at the seams. So we doubled in size. And now it's still a small school. We now take maximum sort of 60 something students, and we've always had one teacher with every 6 students, so we have a very high teacher student ratio. So and students literally from the second year, I had my first American student, and the students come literally from all over the world. We've had people from the Yukon Territory, from Japan, from Indonesia, from China, from all over Europe, etc. So it's very cosmopolitan. And I have to tell you, this place is better than Tinder any day, basically, because there are so many wonderful romances and our babes are scattered all over the world.
So many incredible alumni. Can you tell us about some of the chefs who were alums?
Ah, well, my goodness, they're sort of all over the place, really, and doing all kinds of fun things. So, I mean, they're in New York. You're in Manhattan, aren't you? You know the girls at King?
Absolutely.
And Jez, I mean, just love their food. Super proud of them, I have to say. Just love, love, love their food. But, right from Tokyo, of course, London, Tommy Mars, and then Clodagh McKenna. I mean, on and on and on. And lots of them have done television as well. Rachel, my daughter-in-law, was a student originally. Rachel Allen, of course. She also does television and writes tons of books. I think 35 or 6 of them at this stage have written best-selling cookbooks. And then there are a lot of them doing artisan bakeries, and I encourage them all to, I say to them, you must look out for a strong farmer with a combine harvester with lots of land so you can grow your own vegetables and have your own hens and orchards and all the rest of it. So we have great fun. I often get a photograph from somebody when eventually they can keep a few hens. And even in Brooklyn out there, you have some people with backyard chickens. But anyway, they send me a photograph of their chickens when they collect their first eggs.
Doreena, let's talk about the holidays. What is Ballymaloe like in the month of December?
A Christmas, oh my goodness, an amazing build-up to Christmas, of course. And I remember Christmases, from when I was a child, and the build-up was over several months. But on Christmas Day, very often the whole, or many members of the Allen family get together in Ballymaloe House on Christmas Day, because on Christmas we close for a few days over Christmas, and we often sit down 55, 60 people, and they would be family and children, grandchildren, and indeed, for that matter, Myrtle's great grandchildren in Ballymaloe. And it's fantastic, it's a great big house, and the children, of course, adore being there because the whole place closed, then they can play all the country house games. They slide down the stairs on trays and land on a mattress at the bottom thing. They play the whacker game, and there's another game called sardines. And so there are all these kind of country house games they play, and then huge Christmas tree and lots of presents and roast turkey and often roast goose as well. And then always a traditional Christmas with the plum pudding and trifle and all the Christmas trimmings, and then everybody has a job. Everybody down to the smallest child will have some little job, maybe putting the napkins on the thing, putting out the crackers. And then the boys usually get jobs, they wash up at the end, and everything would be, lots would be prepared on the day before, the stuffing, or what you call the dressing and cranberry sauce, all of that's prepared. But everybody has sort of joins in the fun of the preparation, so that it's not all on one person. And then we always have a lovely hugging session for the cooks and all of that.
Do you cook, or does the family give you a break during the holidays?
Well, we cook We all cook. We all love cooking. But actually, sometimes, in fact, in our particular family, it hasn't happened for the last few years, but because my children and grandchildren live so close to us, sometimes they go to their other grandparents for Christmas. And, you know, we have to share out our grandchildren with them. And so sometimes we fully celebrate Christmas on about the 18th of December with the tree, the Christmas presents, all of that, a whole Christmas dinner with all the trimmings and everything, all the children dressed up in their little velvet frocks and this, that, and the other. And while Santa Claus doesn't come, he comes Christmas on Christmas Eve. We celebrate this full family Christmas on the 18th of December. And then when it comes to Christmas, they actually either have Christmas at Ballymaloe House, as we mentioned, the Country House Hotel, which is closed on Christmas, and then except for the family. And then we go sometimes to India or Mexico or whatever. Tim and I have celebrated Christmas in all sorts of places. If I'm going to India, I bring them a Christmas cake and a plum pudding and all the rest of it, and make mince pies over there as well. So there are lots of variations on Christmas. I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen this year yet at this point.
So you mentioned a few things I want to go back to explain for our audience. You said crackers. Yeah, you're not talking about the kind of crackers that we put cheese on.
It's sort of like a little cylinder, and then it's wrapped in kind of foil and with two little sort of little bits coming out of the end. And so one takes one end of the cracker and one takes the other, and you pull. And inside there's this sort of little banger, which is just makes a little flashy noise. And then there'll be some little trinket or something inside in the cracker. And always a paper hat, you see, so you put on your paper hat so everybody's in a jolly mood. And always this corny Christmas cracker joke. So they're always, oh my goodness, they're terribly important. And you're not really meant to pull them, or at least we used to. Until the end of the meal. But of course, the minute the children sit down, they all pull their crackers and steal all the grown-ups' crackers. So it's all bedlam. But anyway, that's for all part of the fun. Yeah.
You mentioned a Christmas cake. What is a Christmas cake?
Now, a Christmas cake in Ireland is changing a little bit now, but always Christmas cake. Now, when I was a child, every house would make a Christmas cake. And it would be quite a rich fruit cake, and it was made usually 3 or 4 weeks before Christmas. Now, actually, if we go back right to the beginning, you know, and me, brought up in a country village, in a grocery store with a post office and so on. Well, I remember distinctly around Christmas, local people who had some of their family. Many of Irish people emigrated to America and the UK, and we used to call them the Yanks for some reason. Here they'd come back. Well, you know, people would be waiting for weeks before Christmas, watching the postman to see if a parcel came, and it would have been their family that a parcel came from the Yanks. They would say maybe it'll be presents, but very often with the dried fruit, the sultanas and raisins or whatever. The makings of the cake, as they call it. So then when people got that, they would make the cake. And this was a very important thing. I mean, it would have been a very luxurious thing at a time when people had very few luxuries. And, you keep a few eggs put in the cake, and then people would put a bit of poteen, which is an illicit Irish spirit, or some whiskey on it. And always we, as children, mummy would decide when she was making the Christmas cake, we would all gather round and, you know, take the little stones out of the muscatel raisins and chop the cherries and all the rest of it, and help her to stir it and to cream the butter and everything. And of course, we all were all learning how to make a cake without realizing it. We were learning that skill. The same with the plum pudding. And of course, there was always a tradition that everybody in the family stirred the cake. That was to get it, and indeed the plum pudding. And we made a wish, and you'd close your eyes really tight and think about what you wanted Santa Claus to bring you. And the Christmas cake was cooked, and then it would be wrapped up, have some more whiskey poured over it, wrapped up and kept on for Christmas. And it would be iced with an almond icing and then a white glacé icing a couple of days before Christmas. And glacé, we do a snow scene. That was about the height of our ambition at that stage. You'd slather on this royal icing, and then you'd get a palette knife and kind of pop it up and down so the kind of peaks looked like snow. And then you'd have Santa sliding on a sleigh or something on top of it. And then we'd eat that around the, mummy always cut the Christmas cake on Christmas Eve, and we'd sit down around the fire, having a little Christmas cake and whatever. And then when the children went off to bed, with our putting our having hunted the biggest socks in the house to put at the end of the bed for Santa Claus to put something into. And at that time, that was a time when a little mandarin at the end of your sock and a little cap gown or a little bunty annual or those sort of things were games. And you know, those, what was it, Ludo or those snakes and ladders, I don't even know what they were, but little dolls, you know, tiny things. So that was and then the other one was Christmas pudding. Was always another very rich pudding that was steamed for 5 hours on the first evening, and then it would be put away before Christmas, and then you'd steam it again on Christmas Day. But we always ate the first plum pudding in our house on the evening that the plum puddings were made, with lots of, you know, whiskey cream and brandy butter and so on. And that tasted the most delicious of all, because it was before Christmas. It's such a treat, and we've kept on that tradition ever since.
Oh, it sounds so good. And you mentioned a trifle. What is in an Allen family trifle?
Oh, an Allen. Well, actually, there's an Allen family trifle, and there's also an O'Connell trifle, which is my family. And I think everybody agrees that Mummy's is even better than Myrtle's. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, Myrtle's was made with the French pastry cream, but Mummy's was made with a homemade custard. And actually, Myrtle's was made with, she would make a sponge cake and then cut it, you know, slather it with raspberry jam and cut it and put it in place. But Mummy, actually, we used to make our trifle from, at that stage, you would buy little trifle sponges, they were called. They were like little rectangular rusks that you'd buy in the local shop. And then Mummy would put, again, the homemade raspberry jam on it, cut it up, and then put that down there was a trifle bowl in every house, pretty much. A cut glass, in inverted commas, bowl that was kept just for a trifle every year. And basically, she'd make this wonderful homemade custard, not bird's custard, which some people would use, certainly not. And then she'd put the sponges and then loads of sweet cherry. Oh, she had a very heavy hand with the sherry bottle. And then more custard, more thing right up to the top. And then it should be covered with custard, then it would cool, and she'd put that away, hide it away. And then on Christmas Day or whatever, she would equip lots of cream, and we put lots, about that much thick, about an inch thick of, or maybe quite not quite an inch of softly whipped cream on top, and lots of cherries and diamonds of Angelica and toasted almonds and everything. Some people put hundreds and thousands, but we didn't do that. And then, but in our house then, Mummy always made two huge big bowls of trifle because everybody loved it and there were so many of us. But anyway, I remember when the boys got a bit older and they would go off to midnight mass on Christmas Eve, and they would go and then come back and they'd probably go into the pub on the way back to have a couple of pints of something, ale or something, and then they'd come home starving. They'd cook themselves rashers and eggs and everything, and then they'd go looking for the trifle, and they'd sort of hunt the trifle around the house. And then Mummy would come up next day, and of course half the trifle was eaten. So this happened a couple of Christmas. She'd hide it in a different place every Christmas. In the end, she actually hid it under her bed so that they wouldn't actually be able to get it. They'd have to come into her bedroom. So this became quite a game, to hunt the trifle, sort of a whole thing. But anyway, but we still make, of course, that my mother sadly died a number of years ago. But, you know, isn't this what memories are made of, all of these things? And food in so many ways evoke such happy memories. For those of us who are lucky enough to have lived in a household where there was lots of cooking going on, where so many memories from around the kitchen table and all of that. So, yeah. So the trifle, just, you know, the trifle and the plum pudding. And these recipes have been passed down for generations, both in my family and in Myrtle's family. And they're all part of Christmas.
Now, speaking of recipes, we're going to leave the holidays behind for a second. Your latest book, it's your 21st book, I believe, How to Cook, is out now. You're laughing at the number 21.
I couldn't even find all of them. They're all piled up here. And the first one was literally a little. It was called Simply Delicious. Went to my television series. There it is.
I had look at you.
Brown hair. Look at me. There I am. Wearing a brown hair and red glasses. And Sonia, I still have the red glasses, of course. But so yeah, they. I 21 books, and I seem to be. Every time I write a book, I think that is it. I'm not doing any more. But then no sooner have I actually, written it than I'm sort of, impatient to start all over again, something else. Yeah.
So what is the premise behind How to Cook?
Well, now this book, actually, the working title for all the time was recipes, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 recipes, no kid should leave school without, and without being able to do. And that was the working title. My publishers, and we had so many arguments, didn't really want me to. They thought it would narrow it down too much to you know, people thinking it was just for children or for teenagers something. And but actually, the reality is this book is not just indeed for children. Or for teenagers. It's for so many other people who have left school without the skills, practical skills of cooking, or practical skills to feed themselves properly, and concentration on a career, and suddenly, you know, found themselves helpless. And really, if they, with this book, I've taken a lot of delicious base, you know, basic things like an omelette, like a frittata, like a risotto, like a stew, like a loaf of soda bread, and done lots and lots of variations on the theme. So you can have something that's kind of homesy and, you know, delicious, or it could be something that's sort of like really edgy that you could serve to friends or in a restaurant for that matter, depending on, for example, a basic soup. You know, you can make it so that it's totally traditional, or you can, you know, drizzle a little chili oil with sort of little toasted seeds, or and then a little tahini or whatever over the top, and suddenly it becomes something much kind of sexier or whatever. Or a basic tomato sauce that you can, you know, there's several great convertibles that are like tomato fondue that you can, you know, it can be a topping for pizza, filling for an omelette. It can be a, you know, it can be a sauce for something. It can be served with pasta, you know, on and on and on. So, and then people suddenly say, oh my God, I can cook. I can cook. You know, they suddenly get one recipe. It works. And I'm super, super careful about testing recipes, because I've always felt so strongly that our responsibility as a food writer is to actually make sure our recipes are tested properly.
So, Jerina, you've done so much. What are you up to next? I know you've always got a project brewing, stewing somewhere.
Well, everything has, of course, been interrupted by COVID, as you can imagine. But really here, what we're working towards is making the whole farm, gardens, the greenhouses, the all of that. We have an acre of greenhouses, a legacy of when we were in horticulture. And we grow, we're so fortunate we can grow 80, 90 different crops, maybe 25 different types of tomatoes. We have chickens, we have pigs, our own heritage pigs. We have cows, as I mentioned earlier. So we have this amazing unit of incredible skills in our team and everything. So really we're working towards making this a whole educational food project, you know, so we can pass on the skills to courses and to the next generation. We have little do little farm walks for local children, little farmers clubs. We have you know, teaching children in the local schools how to cook. We link in with 9 local schools through another of my hats, to a slow food project. We link in with 9 local schools and we teach the children how to grow and how to cook. They come up here onto the farm and I run my hands through the soil and show them the wiggly earthworms and get them to listen to the birds and sow seeds. And all of those schools must have a school garden. And I send a chicken coop and 2 hens to all of the schools. So the children learn how to keep hens. They clean out the chicken coop. They put the manure onto the compost heap in the school garden, and that then rots down, goes back onto the soil to make the soil more fertile. So they learn so much, and they, you know, they can learn maths, and they can literally, it's integrated into every subject. And that, of course, was all originally inspired by my lovely friend Alice in Chapinice with her edible schoolyard project. So that's one of the things. So my plan is really, I'm working more and more towards using the whole farm as an educational project. And also we were working on starting a master's in educational food production, at least in sustainable food project, of course, and sustainable food production. And then COVID came. So that's on the back burner at the moment. But I realized that, you know, so many degrees and everything, they're all academic. And I must tell you, you can cut this out if you want to, but so many people got such a wake-up call during COVID. And I remember, I've been going on and on for years about the importance of, for goodness sake, we have to teach our children how to cook for a ton of reasons. I mean, they need to learn the fun of cooking, of being able to cook for themselves and share with them how wonderful it is to be able to, you know, make a little spontaneous meal for your family and friends. The easiest way to win friends and influence people. Since the 1950s, I think, in Ireland, I'm sure same in America, the whole educational system has been encouraging us to concentrate on a set of academic skills, STEM subjects. Why would you, like my nuns in the Wicklow, my lovely sisters, saying, why would you want to learn how to cook? You're never going to need that. We need both kinds of skills. And think of the fun one. I mean, I only have one skill to a certain extent, and that's how to cook, something that my lovely Dominican sisters really did not think was going to get me anywhere. And I've had a fantastic, fun life. I've had the great privilege, and I don't say this, and I really mean this, that I absolutely love teaching people how to cook. I mean, I could be teaching algebra or geometry or something. I mean, I know they're very important, but it's not like teaching somebody how to cook. It's like giving them a gift for life. You teach somebody how to make a bowl of soup or make a loaf of bread or something, and you know, you've given them something that is going to change the quality of their life for the rest of their lives. So I feel really fortunate that I actually, that that's what I do. And I actually love what I do. I'm so lucky that I look forward to coming out to the school every day. I mean, I know a lot of people tell me that, you know, by Sunday evening, they have a sort of knot in their stomach with the thought of Monday morning. But, and I just feel for those of us who are fortunate enough to be doing something we love doing, and despite COVID, it's still been wonderful.
Dreena, you are amazing. Let's do a quick speed round and we'll let you go. Although I could talk to you all day. You must own lots of cookbooks. Do you have one that is a particularly treasured cookbook of yours?
If I was to choose just one, it would be Good Things by Jane Grigson.
What is your favorite kitchen tool?
Oh, golly. I keep thinking an oyster knife, but that's ridiculous. No, I actually think a peeler, one of those swivel top peelers. I think that's, or a pestle and mortar, actually. But swivel top peeler I use more often, yeah.
Do you listen to music in the kitchen?
Sometimes. If I'm tired, I love lovely, soothing classical music. And a lot of the time I can't even identify what it is. I'm not very good at remembering the names of things, but I just, oh, how lovely is that? Yeah, I start to speak even more slowly. Mm. Actually, I'll tell you what, I listen more to the radio, actually, than to necessarily just putting on a CD or something. I love, and then, of course, there's Radio 3, and here in Ireland, we have Lyric FM, which always is lovely music, too. But we have, in Ireland, we have a lot of chat shows and you know, some very good news and current affairs programs that I like to listen to while I'm cooking.
What is the oldest thing in your fridge at home?
Oh my god, I could be blackmailed for life if you could see into my fridge. I have things that go back for years, basically, and I remember I wrote a book a number of years ago called Forgotten Skills of Cooking. And at one stage, one of my daughters, Lydia, who's actually a portrait painter, in fact, with classical training, but she also does little cartoons and everything. She did a brilliant cartoon of the forgotten flavors of Dorina's fridge. But I hate to throw things out. And actually, I was brought up, remember, well, oh my goodness, so many years ago. I'm 73 years of age now and happily 73. But basically, I remember if the jam, mummy would make all the homemade jams during the season, you know, and if jam got some mold on top, you know, we'd just scrape it off and eat the rest of the jam. And I remember I was telling this to Timmy one time, and he said, well, in our house, he said, mummy would just say, stir it in, it's penicillin. You know, there you are, so that'll tell you. So I remember once I had this wonderful salami and everything, and my lovely treasure in the house, and I have two wonderful treasures who look after me from time to time. And of course, I went about doing something about my fridge. And so anyway, throughout this, what they thought was definitely there far too long, a bit of salami, you know, wonderful saucy song. And of course, I came home and opened the fridge and said, where is my whatever? And there was sort of kind of silence or whatever. And the next thing was somebody saw Mary racing down to the skip to retrieve the whatever. But at that stage, that's a number of years ago. And of course, it would have looked very strange. It would have had a mold on it probably, but mold doesn't faze me at all, as you could tell. But anyway, so I don't know what's the oldest thing in my fridge, but it's a standing joke in this family. But I was brought up, there's actually a slightly more serious point to be made here in a way, because I was brought up a long, long time before sell-by dates and ask-for dates. So I judge by looking at something, smelling it, tasting it. I always used to joke that if you could hear it, there was time to throw it out. But I can't even say that any longer now because we do so much fermenting. We have a fermentation shed here and all the rest of it. So, but I would always, I mean, I buy very little of anything that has sell-by dates or best-before dates on it anyway. Actually, it's very serious now how much food waste there is because people have lost that skill mm-hmm. to actually have the confidence to use their own senses. And of course, we're playing right into the more we throw out, the better it is for the food processing companies. So in a way, let's take back control and mm-hmm. And upskill again. Yeah.
Dorina, what is a dream travel destination?
We love India. We love Mexico. I've been to Burma, Japan, and Vietnam, Cambodia. I haven't been to Georgia. I'm longing to go to Georgia. I actually love Romania. There are many places I'd like to go back to, but now at my age, I keep thinking, well, I better make a bucket list and just, but you know, oh my goodness, did we live through the golden age of travel?
All right, last question. If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be and why?
I was rather thinking Barack Obama, but I wondered, does he cook at all? I'm not sure.
I don't think he does.
About that. Well, I think it would have to be me and Alice. And we'd have a lovely time chatting together, and we'd cook and we'd forage together. Of course, I'm a real foraging nerd as well. So we'd forage, we'd have long walks, and we'd paddle in the sea. It would be lovely. Yeah, it would be really lovely.
That sounds perfect. Well, Dorina, thank you for all this time and just for everything you've done. You are such a trailblazer in so many ways. You really are the bomb. You're amazing.
Thank you. Come back and see us soon.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Dorina Allen of Ballymaloe Cookery School for joining us. Check out Dorina's latest cookbook, Dorina Allen, How to Cook. And you can learn more about Ballymaloe at the website cookingisfun.ie. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our show. If you're baking this month, and I'm sure you are, pick up some Kerrygold butter or cheese at your favorite grocery store. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Magazine. If you enjoyed this episode, check out our chats with other food world legends, including Nigella Lawson and Ina Garten. Thank you to our assistant producer, Jenna Sadu. And thanks to you for listening. You're the bomb.